Hi, this is Scott Wilkinson, host of Home Theater Geeks. In episode 199, I chat with Alan Sides about his recording engineering career and his philosophy of speaker design. So stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded March 27th, 2014. Episode 199, Digital Audio and Analog Speakers. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, the Home Theater Geek and editor of AVSForum.com. This week's guest geek is Alan Sides, owner and founder of Ocean Way Recording and Ocean Way Audio, two related businesses that we're going to talk about today. Hey, Alan, welcome to the show.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, thanks. Thanks so much for being here.
Glad to be here.
Now, those of you who are tuned in live at live.twit.tv or logged into the chat room at irc.twit.tv can post questions for Alan as we go. And I will pass along as many as I can. So Ocean Way Recording is one of the top studios in L.A. and has been for a long time. I heard of it many, many years ago when I was covering the pro audio industry. When did you start it? How did that come about?
Well, I started Ocean Way in about 1971. And it really started in a garage on a little street called Ocean Way in Santa Monica.
Hence the name.
Ah, yes. Ocean Way. And we operated there for a couple of years pretty successfully. But, it was a question of the neighbors were complaining, late night sessions and such. So a friend of mine, a guy named Bill Putnam, owned the United Western Studios, which were in Hollywood. And United Western Studios started around 1958 and pretty notable place. And Bill had one extra room that he leased me. And I sort of moved from Ocean Way, the garage, to Hollywood. And then over a period of time, I ended up taking over all the rooms and then the building next door and kind of expanded and expanded and expanded. And eventually it was all Ocean Way. But Ocean Way sort of moved to Hollywood around 1976.
Mm.
77.
So it's been in operation now for quite a long time. Who are some of the artists that have passed through the doors there?
Well, it's funny. Originally, when I bought the building, I actually bought it from Bill Putnam, and actually Frank Sinatra was a partner in it. And so when Frank started Reprise Records, or Warner Brothers Records, and left Capitol in 1961, Frank, Sammy, Dean, Bing, they all came here, and every album after that was recorded in these rooms. And I think one of the first albums that I came down to a Sinatra session, a friend of mine, well, I should say, when I was a little kid, I was a hi-fi kid, and I used to install hi-fis for various folks. And one guy did a system for his name was Sonny Burke, and he was Sinatra's producer. So he invited me down to a Sinatra session with Nelson Riddle. And that was, I was probably 13.
Mm.
One of my first sessions. But Ocean Way, it's been quite a cast of characters. You know, we have a very eclectic mix of people. I mean, we've done everything from, we did all the Michael Jackson albums, Lionel Richie's All Night Long, I Will Always Love Thee, Whitney Houston, Green Day, American Idiot. We did, one day, 50 Cent in the club. We do Dr. Dre is one of my best clients. So it can be Andre Previn, one day, and you just never know. It's a really real mix because we can do large orchestras. We can do, anything you can imagine.
Mm-hmm.
Last week, James Taylor was doing an album in Studio A, and I think Eric Clapton was in Studio B. And we've done most
at the
of
same
Eric's
time.
Records. Yeah. Oh, we used to, we did Genius Loves Company with Ray Charles. We did, Riding with the King with Clapton, B.B. King. We did that album.
Mm-hmm.
So, I said, we do a lot of film stuff. Avatar was mixed at our studio. We're fully set up for 5.1 film mixing or 8.1 or 12.22 or whatever configuration it is. It's changing constantly.
It does change constantly. I'm going to ask you about that in a little while, but
sure.
You mentioned, Frank Sinatra and Nelson Riddle. It reminds me that didn't happen to be that live album. Basically a concert that they recorded in the studio all at once, was it?
No. Yeah, this was, it was the Summer Wind with Nelson Riddle was the first thing. But Yeah, I mean,
only reason I mention that is that my trombone teacher was on that live gig, and he had some interesting stories to tell.
Was that the trilogy
about that
record? Was that the trilogy?
I think it's called live or concert in the studio or something like that.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's neither here nor there. It's just a little connection there for me. And now you're working, you continue to work with artists. I understand you're working on a Chris Botti record now.
Yeah, working on Chris Botti right now. And I've done his last couple of records, and I did a show in Boston, which is a nice DVD of that, which has an interesting eclectic cast. The last one we did had Vince Gill was on it, and Mark Knopfler was on it, and Bocelli was on it. We did that. It's a pretty good record. And I did Josh Groban's last two albums, which Rob Cavallo produced. And right now I'm doing all the American Idol stuff.
And tell us about that, the American Idol stuff. I mean, that's a show on TV where people sing and compete and get judged and what have you. But isn't that performed live?
Well, yes, it is. What we do is Ricky Minor, who's the musical director for American Idol, and he was Jay Leno's, musical director. And when Jay finished up, he went back. He was at American Idol during the peak when Kelly Clarkson was there and all those big acts were going on. He was producing all of the album versions for iTunes. And also his band, he plays live. He's the band. He does the arrangements for the show. And he left to go to Leno because Leno paid him some serious money. And then Idol really wanted him back. So he came back this year. And the stuff we've done is really good. And so what we do here is, and actually the studio I'm sitting in is right behind my Ocean Way Studios in Hollywood. It's a studio that I designed and built for Ricky. And we track all of the American Idol stuff, meaning we'll record, say, 11 or 12 songs on Saturday. We'll do all the vocals, the backgrounds, the horns and strings, both here and at Ocean Way, which is right across the street here. And then we'll mix everything on Sunday night, Monday, and I'll master it at 6:45 in the morning. It'll be up on iTunes to purchase that Tuesday. So when the show goes on, if there's any song that you like, you can buy the completed full version of that on iTunes, and that's what we do.
Ah, so you record what they're going to play or have played and performed on the show, perhaps a little differently, maybe a slightly different arrangement, extended versions, whatever.
They do like a minute and a half version of the show, and we do a full.
I got you.
We do a fairly polished version. They're really quite good.
Mm-hmm.
This year, relatively audiophile, all recorded in 96K, and it's actually quite hi-fi.
Yeah, well, this is what I wanted to ask you about in terms of recording. You mentioned that you're recording at audiophile at 96K kilohertz, which is the sampling rate. CDs are 44.1 kilohertz at 16 bits. I assume you're using 24-bit resolution.
Yes.
What are the advantages that gives you over just recording regular CD quality?
Well, of course, I come from the analog era. You know, if I had a 30 IPS analog 2-track and I'm recording off the bus with original Scotch 250 tape, it was pretty close to stealing what the input sounded like. It sounded amazing how good it was. And when Pro Tools came along, which is the digital format that we use, 44.1, 16-bit, it was pretty horrible. I mean, it was so bad that it was unimaginably bad. And I went through a state of depression for some period. Recording that format.
Yes. Like, oh no, I've got to go back into the studio and record 44.1/16.
Well, even worse than that is that most of the studios, the way they're set up, is that you couldn't really hear the input. All you would ever hear, you'd go through Pro Tools. So everything you heard was that. So you never even knew what the mic sounded like because there was no way to hear input.
Right.
You know what I'm
saying? Part of the problem though, in those days, wasn't it? Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it was that, at least in part, the electronics, the digital to analog converter in particular, it was nasty. It wasn't performing up to what it should be doing. Things are a lot better these days, aren't they?
Much, much better. But in the same respect, you know, when you start getting into the much higher sampling rates, and this is something I will say, is I do a lot of film scores. And so I was over at Warner Brothers doing a score not long ago, and I record all my film stuff at 192. And I think the 192 thing sounds unbelievable. I think there's more difference. To be honest, if you have 48K or 44.1 and everything is right, the converters are right, the clocks are right, and everything's, and you compare that to 96, clearly 96 is better, but it's not all that much better. But Jesus, to me, for 192, the resolution that I get, the low-level high-frequency ambient material is amazing. I'll tell you where I really find it. Say that I'm recording an acoustic guitar. It's a fairly dark acoustic guitar, and I record it with no EQ, just straight, get the level just right. And say I want to EQ it after the fact. If I record that at 44.1 and I EQ it after the fact, it sounds utterly different than it does if I EQ it coming off the mic. Because all that low-level high-frequency amp material, basically, it just isn't there. I don't know how else to put it.
Well, when I get, but here's a question I have about that particular thing, which is presumably you're EQing in the digital domain. In other words,
I'm using analog EQ.
Oh, it's all analog EQ. Okay, so it's the mic, the signal from the microphone. The microphone produces an analog signal.
Sure.
It goes into an analog-to-digital converter. Converts it into 2496 or 24192 or whatever. Right. And then if you want to EQ it, you're going to send it back out a digital to analog converter before you apply that EQ, correct?
That's right, because generally speaking, I'm mixing, I'm trying to get the highest res I possibly can in the initial recording format, but I'm mixing on an analog console. And I love the sound of analog equalizers. I'm really not a fan of high-frequency boost and digital equalizers. Clearly, it's better in the higher sampling rates, but it doesn't compare to my best analog equalizers in any respect. So what I'm saying to you is that the harmonic structure coming off the mic as compared to coming off the playback is a whole. It sounds like a different EQ because you're not hearing all this air. When you bring it up off the mic, you hear all this resolution. When you bring it up off the 44.1, it's not there. Now, when I record at 192 and I EQ, it comes back. I actually hear much more of what the mic sounded like. So that's, I guess, one of the reasons I like it a lot.
Theoretically, though, I mean, just so that everybody understands, the sampling rate that we're talking about here, 44.1, 48, 96, 192, sort of determines the highest frequency that you can reliably record. And it's basically half. The frequency that you can record is half of that sample rate. Now, at 44.1 or 48, you can reasonably record up to 20 kilohertz or a little higher. And certainly, human beings can't hear higher than that. You and I certainly can't even hear that high. I certainly can't hear that high. Over 35 can't hear that high. So my question is, where is the advantage of recording higher frequencies that we can't hear anyway?
Well, one of the things is that the brick wall filters are fairly nasty sonically.
Let's explain what brick wall filters are.
Well, you have to. Explain. Feel free.
Well, you have to basically filter out everything above half the sampling rate from getting into the digital system to begin with. Because if you don't, you're going to have all kinds of nasty artifacts, typically called aliasing. And so you have to filter that out. But if you want everything 20 kilohertz and below to get through and everything above 20 kilohertz to not get through on a 44.1 system, you have to have a very, very steep filter that cuts things off very rapidly. And that creates its own set of problems, right?
Well, that's true. And the filters are one of the ugliest parts. So the thing is that when you start getting a higher sampling rate, especially 192, there are no filters. I mean, your bandwidth is sufficient that filters aren't really a problem. So also, most of these filters have a number of stages involved. In the early years, of course, the filters were in the analog domain, and you might have gone through 6, 8, 10 amplifiers and a filter. You know what I mean? You're going through a lot of circuitry you don't need to go through. So when you go up to higher sampling rates, get rid of the filters, that sounds much better. But the other thing is, it's not just the frequency you're going to, it's the amount of samples at that frequency. So in other words, if you're sampling 192, you're gonna get a lot more resolution at 15K than you would if you're at 44.1. Because there's more samples at that given frequency. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
There's more resolution at that frequency. So, like, remember, we go back to when Philips invented the CD, and, you know, Philips and Sony were cooperating, and Sony wanted to go originally 50K or 48K, and Philips said, no, 32K, because that's the European broadcast standard, 15 kilohertz. Nothing about that is irrelevant, you know? So they sold at 44.1, but it could have easily, 50K would have been no problem on a CD. So, but 32 would have been really bad.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true.
Right. So we end up with sort of
that sort of medium. Yeah. Right. QNX Monkey in the chat room is asking, What are your thoughts on DSD, which is the digital format for the disc format called SACD, and its future in pro recordings? Will it ever replace PCM? PCM standing for pulse code modulation. Basically, that's the type of digital encoding that's used on CDs and most digital recording these days, except SACD, which uses this other thing called DSD. What do you think of DSD?
Well, I like, you know, it's funny that my first experience with DSD, I was doing a record with Joni Mitchell called Both Sides Now. And we did the album in London, but then we came here and did all the overdubs and I mixed it here. And I mixed to Meitner's first DSD converters, the prototype converters. Mm-hmm. And I will tell you that I mixed it was a 5.1 recording as well as a stereo. And 5.1, I was mixing to an ATR 124 16-track analog machine as one format. I was mixing to 9624 as another format, and I was mixing to DSD. And I will tell you that DSD sounds unbelievable. I mean, it really was. And of course, my reference is always, here's the input, here's the three recording mediums. So always, you know, and all the levels are exactly matched. And I thought DSD was amazing. The problem I had with DSD is that somehow between the time you make that recording and it gets down to the final SACD, it doesn't seem to be quite as good as it should be.
Really?
You know, I can't tell you. You know, it's very distressing to me that there's some things that are very difficult to measure, but they're very audible. And, you know, I get upset when you can't quantify something in clearly technical terms, but yet it's clearly audible. It's very frustrating.
That's very frustrating. Absolutely. Because it leads some people to sort of go, woo, woo, woo. You know, it's like, oh, it's, you know, if it can't be quantified, it's not valid in some way.
Well, let's talk about this. I mean, you know, back when we were making CDs and Philips set up the standards and we were mixing to their 1610 or 1630, which basically was a video transport and that is the front end. And then they would take that to the plant and they'd you know, cut the glass masters to make the CDs right off of that. And what we found is that one copy from a 1630 to 1630 was noticeably degraded. I mean, it would be about, I would say, an 8% loss in sonics. And so sometimes you would make these, say Bernie Grauman or Doug Sachs would do the mastering, and then you send this 1630 to the label. The label would make copies and send it to the plants. Sometimes the plants would make copies of that. You might be three generations down, and so you end up, you have a ref from your mastering house, and then you get a finished CD, and it doesn't sound anywhere near as good as the original CD.
Mm-hmm. How can that be?
Well, that's like, have you ever heard of the XR CDs, you know, that JVC did?
Yeah.
You know, Alan Yoshida, who worked for me in a mastering, did a lot of these, and they're really exceptional. And JVC did a lot of testing, and they have a plant where they have, you know, a bunch of presses, eight presses. And they did tests listening to each press. And what they found out, the presses all sounded different. Also, the amount of time the stampers held shut also affected the sonics of it.
Wow.
And you know, it's incredibly frustrating, once again, these unquantifiable but very audible differences. And there's a classic story here I'll just kind of pass along. When Mariah Carey was doing a record, and when she was married to, you know, the president of CBS, and she did an album, and she had a ref from Bernie, sounded great. The album comes out, she gets a CD, and it sounds awful. And something went very wrong. And what they found was that they were double speeding the glass masters of the plant to cut it faster. So they would take the 1630 that came from the mastering house, they put it into a Sonic Solutions, and they'd be able to double speed the glass masters. And that turned out to be a very bad thing sonically. And in Mariah's case, they ate like, you know, 500,000 copies and threw them away.
I was going to say, you mean they threw away all those copies that they probably pressed?
Yeah. Now, today, no one could care less. But back then, you know, she cared. She had a CD ref. This is what it sounds like. Here's the pressing. This sounds awful. Why did it sound that different? And so, you know, you do a scientific process. You go through and figure out what went wrong. And believe me, things go wrong. Well, this is almost, if I may say, you know, like we, you know, you listen to an LP, right? And when an LP first came out, you know, an album that you liked maybe, and it was mastered once again at a great mastering house. And the first pressings that come out are right off that original master tape. Then, unfortunately, 6 months later, the company doesn't want to pay to have the new parts cut at that place, and they do it themselves from 15 IPS Dolby copy. So pressings that you got 6 months later sound half as good as pressings you got in the first 6 months.
Mm.
That kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like my good friend Phil Ramone said to me that if his name is on it, it had to come from the master tape, never from a copy.
And that's one reason why he's got such a good reputation.
Yeah.
Well, talking about high-resolution audio,
yes.
I wanted to definitely touch upon the ongoing but also recent news of Neil Young's Pono player and his whole initiative to bring higher quality music at higher sampling rates, digital music at higher sampling rates, higher bit depths than CD. And this Pono player made by Air Acoustics, which is a very high-end audio electronics company. I'm sure you've heard of this. Maybe you've even talked to Neil about it. What's your hit on the whole thing about bringing higher quality recordings to the mass market?
I mean, to me, anything you can do to promote this is a huge plus, because to me as an engineer, you know, it's, as I say to other young engineers, I say, I cannot make it big enough and wide enough and impressive enough, because by the time it gets down to be an MP3, listening on earbuds, if it's not a good recording, it'll sound really bad. I mean, it's the opposite of what people think. They think, well, now it's going to end this format, so it doesn't matter. Well, it matters more than ever. The recordings that are well done, that are well mixed, that have the nice, they sound much better. So, I mean,
on the high sample rate, high bit depth recordings.
Yes, but I mean, I'm saying that you're just listening to MP3, right?
Yeah.
The difference of the engineering is still night and day.
Now, true enough.
Right, but obviously now all of a sudden you get one of these great recordings and you play it in high res, and of course it's a different world. All of a sudden it's like the door is open and here we go.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you – sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, I don't know if you've seen any of these. Recently I've gotten a couple of links to articles online from people who are saying that sampling rates up to 192 kilohertz, which is what you typically use now, at least on movie scores, and we'll talk about that in a minute, can actually not only not sound better, but can actually sound worse, because you're capturing ultrasonic frequencies that interact with each other and create what's called intermodulation distortion down in the audible band.
I can tell you that I've never found that. I have not found that to be the case. And I'm a snob, sonically. You know, for me.
Well, yeah, you're going to listen for any little problem you can find.
Well, also, I absolutely hate harshness. I love, you know, it's like you. You know, I grew up, you know, standing in front of symphony orchestras, and I know what that sounds like. And to me, like, I just did a recording with a friend of mine who was a young composer. He's a great guy, and we did it. We found this church. We went to 13 churches to find a great pipe organ, and we had it was a quiet enough room to do this thing. And we had 16 brass and we had 4 percussion, and we did this pipe organ thing in it. And, you know, I stand out in the room, I listen to that. That's my reference point. And if I can make it sound like that, I'm a happy guy.
Mm. As we talked about offline, you spent your youth listening to live symphony orchestra. I have spent most of my life listening to live symphony orchestra, which is why I don't necessarily call myself a true audiophile, because to me, any sound recording reproduction system isn't going to match the live experience.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there are levels possible that a lot of people haven't heard. It can sound pretty stunning, but generally speaking, it doesn't.
Right.
Can I say that?
Yeah, sure.
Well, I spent a lot of time as a kid at 20th Century Fox, you know, growing up, but I remember one time I was working at a little hi-fi store called Dow Radio in Westwood, and one of our clients there was a violinist in the Fox Orchestra. And he said, get in the back of the car, and I'd go over, and Alfred Newman would be conducting the orchestra there at Fox, and I would just stand right behind Alfred listening to this orchestra at the Fox stage.
Oh, man.
And I'm telling you. Well, then, you know, and I got a chance to work with John Williams and Jerry Goldsmith, people in that room, and I would walk out and I'd stand behind John Williams, and I'm listening to this, like we were doing movie Jaws 2, and we had two harps, and Jaws 2 was even a better score than Jaws 1. Unfortunately, Spielberg wasn't part of the picture, but the music's amazing. And it just gives me chills to stand there and listen to it. It sounded so good. And then when I would do these things, I'd also record, sometimes I'd do a simultaneous, I'd run an ATR at 30 IPS with a little tube mixer I had set up, and I'd take molts off my Neumann M50s, and run it straight to the ATR and record direct 30 IPS two tracks.
By the way, ATR analog tape recorder.
Yes. And Ampex 30, ATR. Yeah,
Ampex, okay. And 30 IPS is 30 inches per second, the fastest speed at which analog tape is passed through a recorder, which gives you the highest quality, the highest fidelity audio, the greatest bandwidth, dynamic range, and so on. Just making sure everybody understands.
We also have special heads that were made for our machines, so we actually have about an octave more low end than a standard 30 IPS machine would have.
Wow, that's cool.
Because I'm a bass player and a guitar player, so I love my I like my low stuff.
Yeah, I'm cool. That's got it. Okay, listen, Martin in Europe is asking this question about the sequencer software called Logic, which is now done by Apple, I think. It was originally another company. But there's a demo that comes with it. And when you play, he says, when you play it in Logic, it sounds cool. But when I play the CD of the same pop tune, it sounds even better. What's the secret that they do to songs in the studios? So this question has tortured me for 20 years.
Well, here's
any thoughts on that?
Well, here's an odd thing, too, is that, you know, I've got all the technology you can imagine in all my studios. I have never been able to even make a copy of a CD that sounds as good as the CD that I started with.
Even a digital copy? It should be identical.
No. I have never been able to make a copy that sounds as good as the original CD.
Wow.
No, it always sounds worse. You know, and I've tried everything. And it's frustrating to me. You know, it's and sometimes it can sound really bad if it's not done well. You know, but
But it's a bit for bit copy. It should be identical. I don't understand how it couldn't possibly the same. It's not.
No. Mm-mm.
It's almost like generational loss in analog. I thought we were done with that.
It is, but it's different. You know, it's funny because what it gets. How do I say this? I won't say it gets more digital, but it gets, I hate to say that, less wide, a little harsher, a little less round, the low end. It seems to be the characteristics that I relate to as multiple degenerations. And well, like even in the Pro Tools system that we use, right? Mm-hmm. I think you find this interesting. If you take an instrument. I use the Pro Tools more as a recording and editing system, not so much as a mixing system, although certainly I do rides in Pro Tools. But if I had to take, let's say, a piano solo or a big brass section solo, I need to come up 6 dB. If I bring it up in the Pro Tools 6 dB, it sounds noticeably worse than coming out at zero. It degrades the sound. And so I've even done this where I've actually taken in Pro Tools, you can assign any particular instrument out of multiple outputs, and you can take one and bring it up 6, 8, 10 dB and have another one come out at the level it's recorded at. And then you can play it through an analog console and you can match the levels. You can zero it out with tones and then A-B. Right. And the ones that go significantly higher or lower sound like they're truncated. They sound like they're grainier sounding and less clear.
I wonder if that's because of the processing that goes into digital gain.
Well, may I say, because like in the 48K era, I had a Sony Oxford digital console, and that was clean as a whistle. I could change levels all day. It sounded great. So this seems to be a Pro Tools issue, but it's the format that we all sort of use. So generally, when I'm mixing an analog, I recorded high-res digital, I put it up my analog console, and if I'm doing a vocal ride, it's coming out at the normal zero level, and I may do rides of various words and stuff, but they pass in such short duration that you don't notice a quality loss because it goes past too fast.
Right, you know, right.
Yeah.
Right, exactly.
So I give you endless stories of unpleasant sonic things I deal with. but I'll say one more thing, because we were talking about, MP3s, how wonderful they are.
Right.
But the other thing I say is that, like, Sirius Radio, which is what the format is for cars, is got to be the worst sounding thing I've ever heard. It makes MP3 sound like the gold standard.
Oh, man, really?
It's just the grainiest, harshest, and everything is 50% mono. And like channels like the Sinatra channel, which say, well, they're just playing old records, so we're going to have even less resolution on that channel.
Right.
It's like I hear artifacts and weird things going on that have nothing that it's, I say, I don't know what the rate is. A friend of mine from Seattle designed the algorithms, for the original, the pre-Sirius system, which was designed for 100 channels, and now they're running 200 channels.
Oh, so they've got to compress the heck out of it.
I can't imagine. I don't even, the resolution is so low, it's off the map.
Didn't you tell me Didn't you tell me that Sirius radio resolution is like 2 bits?
I don't even know. I don't know how you would describe it.
Just horrible. All right.
Horrible, horrible, horrible. So, I mean, but, you know, I feel bad for the consumer because that's their reference point, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
MP3s on earbuds and Sirius radio.
And Sirius radio. Well, Thank you. Hopefully now Pono, Neil Young, is bringing higher resolution, the awareness anyway, of higher resolution audio to a wider audience. And hopefully we'll see more acceptance of it and maybe more content produced in it.
Yeah.
You know, because again, you know, if the public sees it, understands it, wants it, and of course they need to hear it in order to really understand it. I mean, you and I can talk about it till we're blue in the face, but it really requires a demonstration. It requires somebody to listen to it on a high quality system.
Yeah.
To really understand the benefit.
Yeah, no, and there's enough storage space now to have high res audio. It's not really an issue. But of course, in the film business, you know, which I dealt with, I mean, we don't have to have data compressed audio. We can finally listen to a motion picture and have 48K non data compressed audio.
Mm.
I come from the peak of Sonics for me in films, apart from going back to, you know, the Taddeo stuff or Sound of Music, that sort of stuff, what that was. But looking at the 70 millimeter, you know, SR six track was probably, you know, about as good as it got at that period of time. It sounded great. And when you went to the Dolby Digital and the DTS, the DTS was certainly better than Dolby Digital, it was pretty ugly sounding.
Right, because it was data compressed.
Yeah, it didn't sound anything. I mean, I remember being at the Academy Theater and they're doing ABs. I did this one picture called Geronimo with Walter Hill, and I remember we're seeing a 70 millimeter six track, and then we're listening to the Dolby Digital, and there's just no comparison.
Right.
Exactly. Just no comparison. It was just so much better.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Sorry. I don't want to be a downer.
No, that's all right. No. Totally fine. Totally fine. But McButterpants in the chat room with one of the most interesting screen names ever is asking, how important is vintage gear in modern day recording?
It's a major part of what we do. And I think a lot of that is in microphones. I'm a big collector of tube microphones. And when the European broadcasters were changing up, getting new things, I was buying thousands of microphones in Europe's M50s, KM54s, U47s, U67s, KM53s, et cetera. And some of those mics are just so exceptional, I can't even describe what they sound like. And, I don't think there's a microphone made by Neumann or AKG that even approaches what they made, you know, in the 60s, sonically.
Right.
And so there's that. And then there is really good discrete analog circuitry that was available in transistor stuff, discrete.
Or even tube stuff.
Oh, excellent. There's some excellent tube stuff that, you know, super wide bandwidth, really quiet, just superb sounding stuff. And that's not to me. There's some great stuff that's made today, but some of that stuff was outstanding. Some of the equalizers and things that were around. And so, you know, we've always made sort of, we have a passion for that stuff, finding the things that sound unique. And that's that's what our studio has always been about, is that kind of thing.
Do you, where do you come on the spectrum of tubes versus solid state? Both have their place, sounds like?
They're both, you know, a great transistor circuit is great. A great tube circuit is great. I'm not sure to say one. They're different, but I wouldn't say one is necessarily better.
Right.
Because there's a lot of tube stuff I like, and there's a lot of transistor stuff I like.
Right. It all depends on the situation, I'm sure.
Yeah. And there's bad tube stuff and bad transistor stuff, too.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Because of a tube, it doesn't mean it's going to sound good.
SoundPro69 is saying the Pono has 128 gigabytes of internal storage. And Neil Young says it will hold 1,000 albums in master audio quality.
Yeah.
But a CD takes 650 megabytes, which is true, or 700 or so. So can someone tell me how he will fit them all in there? In FLAC, which is a lossless audio compression, data compression, would only compress the file size by about a factor of 2.
Right. Yeah, I don't know. It's not my area of expertise.
Yeah, understood. Yeah. What Magpie is asking, what's your opinion of FLAC encoding?
I'm really not that familiar with it, so
yeah. Okay.
Yeah, so I can't
no problem at all. I got a question back here a bit. Martin in Europe was asking for any funny experiences, failures, outtake situations with well-known recording artists. I don't know if you want to really share any of that, but
well, you know, being a studio owner, I can say we've had some good ones. I remember one day we had a new analog machine that had three CPUs in it. It was a pretty complex piece of work, and the manufacturer was actually adjusting and aligning the machine, and we had a reel of tape with in the front of it was the test pad where you'd line it up, and the song was leader, and the song after that. And so this guy's working on the song, aligning the machine, and he goes past the leader and keeps on going. And so we get ready to do the horn session, and it's Earth, Wind, and Fire, and the song has been erased.
Oh, no.
There's no song.
Oh, no.
So there's some good ones like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, no, man. So you had to go back and re-record. Oh, man.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay, one more question about recording, sure. And then we're going to actually move on to speakers and audio equipment, which I know you also deal with.
Right. Yeah.
And that is dynamic range compression. We've been talking about data compression here. MP3 can compress as much as 90% of the audio data out of it, so the file is only 10% of the original. Lossless audio compresses by about a factor of 2. But then there's dynamic range compression, which is the difference between the loudest and the softest sounds you can hear. And that's that's reproduced and re-recorded. And 16 bits gives you a theoretical range of 96 dB. 24 bits gives you, 144 dB. Something like that. But so often music, popular music in particular, is recorded and that dynamic range is squashed down. Why do they do that? And how can we move past that? Because it really does kind of make things sound very homogenized.
Well, I mean, from a pop standpoint, you have a song and your verse starts out big and your chorus is smaller than your verse and your bridge is smaller than your chorus. Nothing ever goes anywhere. It's all at one steady state level. And there's no impact. There's no dynamic range. And that's really where a lot of stuff has gone. As a mixer, I come from a different place entirely, and I hardly ever use any compressors. I like very wide dynamic range. I love impact. I love punch, all that thing. And that's a big issue these days. And part of the problem, too, is from a mixer standpoint, if I want to make a recording really sound good, I may have to do quite a bit of manual adjustments to get everything in the right place, then do things the song progresses. If I put a compressor across it, everything sort of lays there, and it more or less works without having to work near as hard. And a lot of mixers just put a compressor across and say, here I go. Nothing's too loud, nothing's too soft, everything's just fine. And it fills the space sonically, but there's no joy, for me at least.
Yeah.
But you have to work harder when you don't use compressors. Like, when I'm doing vocals, I work with this artist, Josh Groban, quite a bit, and Josh has got a very wide dynamic range. When I put a compressor on him, it just takes all the life out of his voice. Mm-hmm. So I record with no compression, and sometimes I'll even actually record two simultaneous tracks. One tend to be hotter than the other one. And so what it allows me to do is be in a higher bit rate on the lower level stuff. You know what I'm saying? So, yeah, the one that's tend to be hot is actually distorting when he's playing loud. But when he's quiet, the low-level stuff's at a much higher resolution point. And so when I do my comps, I'm working from fairly high resolution.
You know what I'm saying? And what does that mean, comps?
It means that let's say I do, three or four vocals, and I pick the best parts from those four vocals I do.
Oh, okay. So maybe verse one from this track and verse two from that take. And you put them together. Okay, got it.
Right, but then I'm taking some of the quiet stuff and I'm bringing it up a bit level-wise. But I'm bringing it up, it's recorded at a higher level, so it's got more resolution.
Right.
So I like to be able to optimize things manually with, just by riding levels and not using compressors.
Sounds good to me.
Okay. I mean, I used to do these, direct-to-disc and live to two-track recordings. Mm-hmm. And, you'd sit in the control room, you're listening to what's coming out of the speakers. And I've heard things that are, it's exciting to listen to, what I'm saying? And I'm hearing less and less of that.
You said you worked a lot on movie soundtracks, which are, of course, 5.1, 7.1 or whatever. Right. What do you think about multi-channel music recordings?
Well, I mean,
recording music for an album, like a Blu-ray audio disc, for example, that's in 5.1.
I love 5.1. I mean, I'm just especially for any sort of orchestra. It's just so much fun to listen to. And so when I do film stuff, obviously it's depressing me to do the stereo because the 5.1 is so exciting. So yeah, I'm a big 5.1 fan. The question is, it's like, not long ago I was working with Phil Collins on an album, and you know, 5.1 was kind of rolling along. He says, well, why don't we remix like In the Air Tonight and all this classic stuff in 5.1, which I mixed all of it in 5.1. It sounds great, but there really wasn't a release format because the format
faded
away.
Yeah.
And so I've got a lot of things in the vault that sound amazing that I can't release because there's really no place to release them. There's no existing, you know, format other than, you know, Blu-ray that you'd play as a music video or something.
Right. You'd need to have some video on it.
Yes.
I mean, this is Mark Waldrop's thing with AIX Records, is he records music in 5.1,
right,
and includes video that he shoots at the recording session.
That's great.
So, I think that's kind of a cool idea.
That is a great idea because it's a pretty good format. Blu-ray sounds pretty good. You know, you can get some pretty good resolution.
Yeah, exactly. And here's a question from Beatmaster that I would have asked myself also. Do you prefer the 5.1 mix putting you in the audience, which means more or less ambience in the surrounds, or in the middle of the orchestra with instruments all around you?
I really, you know, especially from a theatrical experience, I like to have the orchestra on the stage, and I like to have just ambience around me. And I can get completely enveloped with that, but still have the energy in front of me instead of around me. I'm not a big fan of being in the middle of the orchestra. Although I will say, it's funny, it's sort of fun to walk around the orchestra when they're rehearsing.
You know? I agree.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I prefer to have the instruments all around me because that's what I'm used to as a performer. I'm sitting in the middle of the orchestra. But that's not the typical experience, and the typical consumer won't enjoy that experience as much, I don't think, because they're more used to being in the audience. So they want an audience-centric experience, which is why Mark, actually on his releases, gives you the choice. He says you can choose the audience mix or you can choose the onstage mix. And so I kind of like that approach as well.
Well, I'm kind of, my spot is I like to stand behind the conductor. I don't want to be in the audience. I want to be right there.
I want to be right there, right next to the, right behind the conductor.
Well, you know, when Disney Hall first opened up, I went down there, and I think Tilson Thomas was doing the suite from Alfred Newman's from How the Whistles Went, which is a really great thing.
Great, it was in rehearsal. Yeah.
So I just walked every inch, you know, all the way on the bases or up in the, just to hear where it sounded the best in the space. Kind of fun to listen to it, you know. There's no audience to just kind of, you know, fool around.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to speakers, because I know that you also run Ocean Way Audio, which is an audio company that you design and build speakers. In fact, you have some behind you right now I wanted you to tell us about in your studio. Those are speakers of your design. First, tell us how you got into speaker design.
You know, I was really sort of, you know, caught up in the hi-fi thing from a very early age. I think probably 9 or 10, I had some friends who had some interesting things, and I would listen to this music, and I was just so taken by it. And so I also was very interested in the technology, and I would end up buying speakers out of old theaters. I would buy all kinds of interesting old stuff, Altec stuff, RCA stuff, Western Electric stuff, and I would triamp it and biamp and experiment, trying crossovers and different equalizers. And I was doing this since the time I was 12 or 13 years old. And so I started making speaker systems that I was selling, you know, pretty successfully from about 16 years old and on. And I've been doing that. I haven't stopped.
Wow.
And I just, the reason I got into recording wasn't that I had necessarily interest in recording. I just needed material to play on my speakers that sounded good.
And you couldn't find anything commercial that sounded as good as you wanted it to.
Yeah, no, there's a handful of things that sound great, but most of it doesn't.
Yeah.
And so I started, and then I used to hang out at the old Todd AO, you know, and just had some friends who was head there, and they had all these amazing microphones that were just sitting in a box that hadn't been used because they just become a post house. And I ended up getting all these Cine Church mics and U47s and U67s from them for very little money, and I started recording with really great mics right away.
Wow! How fortunate for you!
The wheeling and dealing thing is always kind of fun too, you know. On the
Yeah, I understand. What is your philosophy of speaker design? How do you go about What kinds of speaker designs do you prefer and why?
Well, you know, I'm not stuck on any one design. I am stuck on an end result. And, you know, what I would say is what do I like? Sonically, I like things that have incredibly wide dispersion, which means that I can move around the room and not be stuck in a spot. I like things that have almost no character in it themselves. I like things to sound open and airy. I like to have very wide bandwidth because I'm a bass player. I love my fifth string. I like to play bass. I like low notes. My speakers generally all go really low. The system in here is flat to 18 hertz. Doesn't roll off at all. And I bandwidth to at least 20 kilohertz or above. And the other thing I'm into is having absolutely symmetrical response between sides, where basically the two sides are typically within, say, within a 1.25 envelope of each other from 20K to 1K. So I find that the imaging, it's all about imaging. And when that response, when you have very wide dispersion and really, really matched response between the sides, you end up with phenomenal width and imaging and definition.
Tell us about those speakers. Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, yeah. Go right ahead. Well, then I was going to ask about the speakers.
I really, really hate also is harsh.
Okay.
I hate unpleasant. Anything that's hard. I mean, I want it to be accurate. In other words, I'm looking for a system that if I'm playing a bad recording, it sounds bad. But I'm playing something that's exceptional. I'm going to get excited and say, this is great.
Yeah. So what about those speakers behind you?
Well, this is our HR2 system, and it's a very unusual speaker system. It's a three-way system. The high-frequency horn is unusual in that it's a 120-degree by 40-degree horn. And if you measure the response at zero on axis and you go 50 degrees off of zero, it's identical to zero. There's no difference, none.
Wow.
And that's very unusual. Because even if you just took a dome, a really good dome tweeter, right, when you go 30 degrees off axis – it changes, and you go 4 degrees off axis, the gain changes and the response does change. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not a half circuit. This thing has really good directivity. Now, the low frequency horn also has an identical flare rate to the high frequency horn, and the high frequency driver and the mid bass woofer have identical physical alignment. So it's perfectly time aligned, you know, mechanically.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's an 18, which you don't see, it's below the console on the bottom.
And so 18-inch subwoofer driver sitting at the bottom of that cabinet.
But they're
cabinet.
All in the same plane, and everything's arriving at the same time, because you and I talked about that earlier, is that I really, because I like when my bass drums arrive, I want everything arriving at the same time. I don't want some subwoofer in some other part of the room aiming in a different direction. You can get the quantity, but I want everything arriving at the same time, and so I want a lot of clarity in the low end and definition.
What about the issue, though, of... very often in a room which has acoustic characteristics, all rooms do, that the best place for bass to be coming from in terms of room modes and standing waves and problems that entails, that the best place for a speaker for low frequencies to be coming from is often not the same as the best place for mids and highs to be coming from.
Well, you know, that's the way our system is set up. You can actually change because it's two different cabinets, even though they sit on top of each other.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly correct. What happens sometimes if, depending on the wavelength of the room and if we're getting cancellations or nulls at your listening position, by simply changing the angle at which the bass is, if it hits the sidewalls and then the rear while they're going straight, sometimes you can get rid of that standing wave or that null. And there's ways to fix that because obviously we work in imperfect environments. And so you have to adapt. I mean, the room is obviously a major part of what any speaker sounds like.
Right. Exactly.
And,
right.
Yeah. And so a lot of times when we sell our big systems, we actually work on the design of the room, or if they have an existing space, how we can adapt acoustically and make it work much better in an aesthetically acceptable way. That is not, you know, overly expensive. But there are a lot of things you can do to make rooms sound much better.
Just by positioning where the subwoofer's aimed, if nothing else.
Absolutely. You know, even I had a control room here. I went control room where by changing the angle, I was able to get, you know, a huge difference in the performance of the loudspeaker.
Okay.
But this is one of our systems. Yes, go ahead.
Go ahead. I was just going to say, this is one of your systems?
Yeah. This is.
You got any
others? We have six different systems that we do.
Mm-hmm.
And I should say that we, you know, originally when I started doing this, I would do sort of high-end commercial installations. And that was we would do a couple a year, and it was more of a thing I did for friends. But like we did, I redesigned the control room for George Lucas Skywalker Ranch. That has my speaker system in it. Dave Grohl, I helped him build a studio. He has my speaker system. Rob Cavallo is president of Warner Brothers Records. He has a studio that I helped design for him. He has my speakers. Disney has an executive conference room with my speakers set up in them. So we've done those sort of installations, but we've really got into home hi-fi in the last 6 years.
Yeah, I was going to say, you've been at CES in the last few years in the Venetian with the other high-end audio companies. And I was going to ask you, what is the difference between professional and home speakers, or should there be no difference?
Well, you know, technically there should not be a difference. I would say that, unfortunately, a lot of professional stuff got a bad name because it's synonymous with harsh and loud. But of course, our studios, Oceanway Studios in Hollywood and Record One Studios, all of my studios, what we're known for is great sounding speakers. I mean, you come in our rooms and you play the big speakers and it sounds wonderful. And that's always been, it's one of the most important parts of my studios. I mean, because I have clients, I can go back to my garage where the clients would walk in for a playback, and maybe I've got Hubert Laws and Harvey Mason and all these great players, and they walk in for a playback, and when they hear the playback, it sounds pretty ridiculous. You know, it's pretty exciting to listen to, and that's what I get off on. That's my joy. And I don't want a hype. I want an accurate reproduction, and I want to work to make that happen.
And think that should be the same goal in the home? Because very often I hear that, say, for example, studio speakers, professional speakers need to be very flat, very revealing, whereas home speakers are often tweaked to be kind of maybe the smiley curve where the highs and lows are emphasized a little bit, or somehow so that it sounds, quote unquote, pleasant.
Well, here's the thing. I hear exactly what you're saying. And a lot of speakers that have a relatively flat curve, they can be quite harsh because of problems of intermodulated distortion or things within the components. If the speaker is really, really good and it's relatively flat, the other issue I must say, though, is the space it sits in. If you're in a very, very live environment, a totally flat loudspeaker can be quite harsh. Mm-hmm. There's kind of a matching the curve to the space.
Very good point. SoundPro 69 in the chat room is asking, should the dispersion pattern in professional and home speakers be different?
Well,
I imagine probably depends on the room as well.
Yes. We make a smaller system, you know, that uses a waveguide, and it also has really good dispersion. Same sort of thing, because all of our systems have really wide dispersion. And I have found that's a very positive trait in almost any room. You know, obviously, if you had a tremendous problem with first-order reflections from glass sidewalls, maybe you would want to have somewhat narrow dispersion. Mm-hmm. Or you would have to angle the speakers in such a way that the first-order reflections go behind you instead of in front, you know, next to you.
Right.
Because obviously, we'd like to hear as much direct sound as possible.
Right, exactly.
Right.
But you are going to get reflected sound unless you're in an anechoic chamber, which you don't want to be in.
You don't want to be in. No. I totally agree.
Yeah. Okay. We also talked a little bit off camera about your philosophy that left, center, right, or what are called LCRs, should be full bandwidth, as you've mentioned here on the show as well, down to low as they can go.
Low as they can go.
And using subwoofers only for LFE, I guess.
And they should be equal. They should be of equal quality to what's in the LCR.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? They should go down just as low, and they should all be in the same alignment.
But the only signal the subwoofers are going to get is the super low frequencies on the soundtrack that are assigned to that 0.1 channel.
Yeah, that's correct. That's correct. You know, if we're in a dubbing situation, sometimes there are a lot of theaters, even with the standard JBL theater system, where the individual channels really don't go much below, you know, 40 hertz, and the subs do. So sometimes we'll send some of the music to the subs just to get the concert bass drums and some of the big stuff to sound a little more exciting. So it is still coming out of the three speakers, and it's coming full bandwidth, but the speakers really aren't going down to the 20 hertz range, only going down to the 40 hertz range. And they're relying on the subs to kind of fill in the gap. But like at the Academy, each individual speaker, and there's five speakers on the screen, does go all the way down to, you know, all the way down to 20 hertz. It just depends on how nice the installation is. But I'm not a big lover of bass managed you know, speakers that only got 80 hertz, and you got one box doing the bass for everything. It's not as much fun to listen to. That's my comment.
Yeah. SoundPro 69 follows up by saying, you want direct beaming speakers in the studio and diffuse sound field at home. Do you agree?
No.
Okay.
I don't want beamy speakers at all. The point is, speakers that tend to be beamy tend to be unnatural sounding. They don't sound anything like what the instrument sounds like.
Right. And plus, it's a very tiny sweet spot where you're going to get the best sound.
Well, like, that's always a problem with, like, you know, there's manufacturers that use, you know, various sorts of flat panels for tweeters, right? Elements. The problem is that typically those have about 35 to 40 degrees of usable dispersion, and then you're gone. And once you go off the off-axis point, it's history. And that sounds very very unnatural and very strange to me.
Yeah. Problem with home speakers, particularly the center channel, is comb filtering, right? You've got often a symmetrical mid-ranges and then a tweeter in the middle, and you'll get interference as you move off axis.
That's interesting, because if I'm stuck with having some ridiculously inappropriate center speaker, I'd almost prefer to have my left and right as a straight stereo, like take the LCR, and then have my left-right surrounds in my sub.
Do a phantom center, in other words.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Because people don't realize the center speaker is absolutely as important as left-rights. And if you're minimizing
If not more so.
Yes.
And so, because that's where all the dialogue's coming from.
Well, and the music, too. Everything's coming. And it's a very important channel. And you need the voices to sound wide and big. And it's very important that channel have full bandwidth and be of comparable size. I mean, I do find I like a micro screen in a home theater if I can, because I do like to be able to have the speakers behind the screen. Mm-hmm. Like these speakers here, because they have such a wide surface area, do a phenomenal job of getting through the screen, because they've got a very, very wide surface area. So they get through a micro screen really well.
Yeah. And you could put three of those behind a big enough screen, and get your center channel without having that comb filtering and having totally consistent tonal balance from left to right, which is ideally what you want.
The other thing we do sometimes, if the space is tight, sometimes what we can do is, because all of our three subs that go with the basic system, I can actually provide a separate input as a 0.1 feed to the 318s and not require a separate subsystem. Just basically LCR, and then you can send the 0.1 to the three subs as well.
Right. Perfect. Yeah. Got it. Mike Ellis in the chat room is saying, ask about the real echo chambers at Ocean Way.
Yeah, we have some pretty fab echo chambers, which are Bill Putnam designed them originally, and they're fairly large spaces. They're probably the biggest ones, probably, you know, 25 feet by 10 feet by 9 feet, with some interesting angles and things. And there's a pair of we have a pair of microphones and a pair of speakers in the echo chambers, and so we send the signal to the chambers and bring it back. And it's like, you know, these are extremely live small spaces, and
are they lined with tile or something very reflective?
There's a particular kind of polymer coating they put on the wall. It's got a kind of almost a lacquery, really bright finish. And it's when you stand in there, it's pretty amazing. It's incredibly smooth decay. I mean, our big one here has probably got about a 3.6 second decay, 3.7 second decay. If there's an artist that I'm pretty good friends with, I used to do a lot of records with this guy, Bobby McFerrin. And Bobby used to actually go up. I'd set a chair in the echo chamber, and he would just go up there and sing in the echo chamber.
I love that.
Yeah, so it was really such a long decay.
Now I have to say though that. Real echo chambers, like this, are pretty rare, I think, these days. Of course, everybody uses digital reverb or even analog reverb, but it's an electronic reverb that they add to the one track or another or a mix or whatever. Sure. But what you're doing is what they used to do all the time in the really olden days of recording, which is send the signal down to a pair of speakers or one speaker or two in your case, in a sealed reflective room with some microphones at the other end, and record the sound bouncing around that chamber. It's fascinating. And so you've gone way back to the beginning of recording technology.
Even when Bill first started this place, he actually too was having a stereo send to the chamber. So you were actually sending stereo to the chamber and returning stereo.
Can you even hear stereo with such reverb, with so much reflection going on.
Oh yeah, no, you do. Yeah, no, it's a noticeable thing. You know, it's funny because a lot of like the old Capitol echo chambers, they don't even run stereo send anymore; just mono send. You know, but the stereo send does make a difference. It's a little more complicated to be able to do the send configuration, but it sounds better.
Right. Aphex in the chat room is reminded of something that I was too. Actually, I don't know if you're familiar with Star Trek: The Next Generation.
Yes.
There's an episode where Picard and a woman that he's involved with go into the Jeffrey's tubes and start playing music, and because this is where the acoustics were the most perfect. I just thought that was hilarious.
I worked on Star Trek One, the first one, which Robert Weiss directed.
Jerry Goldsmith.
Yeah, and then at that point, Fox had a pipe organ on the stage, and Craig Huxley had this aluminum beam that he brought down, which is about, it was like an I-beam with strings on it that you could play like a pedal steel.
Yes, like, I saw, it's called a beams or a
they
beam?
They call it the beam, yes.
Yeah, I saw that years and years ago. It was beautiful. What a sound.
It's a great sound.
Yeah, it was funny
because Jerry, we had worked on it for about 4 days, and then in the movie was a little on the dull side, might I say. And
yeah.
Jerry had to really fill some space, Gary Goldsmith, you know. These interminable shots to the Enterprise, you know, it's like, right, here it comes. Right. It's coming.
More of that.
Eventually, we're going to get there.
Yep.
And so, they actually threw the whole score out, and then Jerry came back with the beam, and it was fine.
Got it.
So, anyway.
That's pretty cool. Web3808 asks, are 2 6-inch speakers equivalent to 1 12-inch speaker since the total surface area is the same?
Yeah, they can be. And sometimes it's, we have one system where we use 2 12s. And, you know, it's interesting. I get the smaller cone sometimes can sound really great compared to the large cone. Depends on the situation.
Probably the smaller cone has a quicker response time because it's
faster.
Less mass to get moving, as it were.
In our AS1, we have a aluminum cones, very light cones, aluminum voice coils, and huge magnet structures, and they can move an amazing amount of air. You know, we make speaker systems. You know, our biggest system, which Dr. Dre sort of uses, I originally built that for Michael Jackson, actually, but. Each speaker is 9 feet high and 7 feet wide. It's a three.
That better be
system.
A pretty big room.
It's a pretty big control room. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's. You can click on our website. You can go take a look at these speakers. They're big, big, big.
Yeah.
But yes.
One last question for you.
Of course.
You were talking about time alignment and how your speakers are designed so that the sounds are coming at you from the same distance and therefore arriving at the same time. That's a very important characteristic. You can also achieve that electronically. Is there any reason to not do it that way?
Yes. I'm not fond of digital time correction. If your point is, what if you're playing an analog source? That means you have to convert to digital to listen to it through converters, through converters that you wouldn't even consider listening to, generally speaking. You know what I'm saying?
It's
in these boxes. And the other thing is that like a lot of self-aligning systems they make now, and they have all digital equalization. You put up a little microphone, it analyzes your speaker. And yeah, it's not bad, but the EQ, the digital EQ, particularly in lower sampling rates, the high frequency EQ is pretty awful sounding. It's not very good sounding. So we actually make custom analog equalizers with hand-wound coils for every frequency, super fast electronics. I have no complaints with equalizers. I just want quality, and I tend to prefer an analog signal path, and I'm not a big fan of digital crossovers and digital time correction.
Got it. Well, then that leads to really my last question, which is you were talking earlier about, converting from analog to digital, coming into your recorder, converting back to analog for EQ. And then I assume converting back to digital again for final distribution, the more conversions you go through, the more chance there is for problems. Isn't there?
This is true. But the thing is that I'm recording, say I record the source at 192. So it's as high a res as I can.
Yeah.
So I'm going to end up at 44.1 or 48 kilohertz. So I'm mixing into the best converters I have, best front end converters I have, but I'm coming from a real high res source. Do you know what I'm saying? So
yeah,
it's like you're coming closer to the mics. And because I much prefer the sound of the analog console, I can repaint the picture in an analog console, where digitally, it's much more difficult for me. Now, if I record everything, I can mix in the box, as they say, and it sounds fairly decent because everything's well recorded to start with. But if I get a recording in that's not well recorded and needs a lot of finessing and tweezing and such, it's very difficult for me in the digital domain to get what I want. I can make it work, but I can make it work much better on a good analog console.
Got it. We've come to the end of a fascinating hour. I want to thank you so much for being here and sharing such great information.
Well, thank you very much. It was fun. I appreciate your knowledge of the of this whole thing.
Well, it's something I've been fascinated with since I was a kid as well. In junior high, a friend of mine and I started our recording business, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. It has been a bug in my ear ever since. So once again, thank you so much. That's Alan Sides of Ocean Way Recording and Ocean Way Audio at the URLs you might expect online, oceanwayrecording.com and oceanwayaudio.com. You can find me at avsforum.com. You can email me at scott@twit.tv. And you can follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott, also at avsforum. Avsforum, that's the Twitter handle there. You can also find previous episodes of Home Theater Geeks right here at twit.tv/htg. Also on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/twit. Home Theater Geeks. Now, next week will be episode number 200 of Home Theater Geeks. Woohoo! I'm very happy to have reached this milestone, and to help me celebrate that will be a couple of our most popular guests from the past 4 years, including headphone guru Tile Hertzens and 3D maven Gene Dolgoff. And who knows, I might be able to pull another person or two into the mix to talk about what they're expert at, which is always what we talk about here on Home Theater Geeks. And I do hope you will join me for the celebration. Until then, geek out.